Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for taking your valuable time out this evening, this day, to listen to the podcast. Normally, I go into the hot news and burning issues or pull a story off of the wire, as they used to say, but off of the net on a popular topic or maybe an unheard of topic in the mainstream media, whether it's the real issues in the Gulf from the hundreds and thousands of fishermen and business owners that are at their wits' end because they haven't received checks from BP, the draconian laws that are being passed in our nation's capital here in the United States that are taking away even more liberties and freedoms away from us, but they're doing it at a time where many people are so stressed and unsure of what is going to happen. Doing this, ladies and gentlemen, doing the podcast at a time where many people are suffering more psychological ailments, more physical ailments than ever before, because we're trying, attempting to cope with many of the challenges that we're facing, and we're trying to bury them with drugs, with alcohol, with food, and we have no idea what the long-term ramifications are going to be. So I took sort of a holiday on Thursday, not to put a downer on anyone's celebration for the 4th, ladies and gentlemen, and the title of this podcast is called It's Time to Celebrate, because I want to give you first a story, and I just want you to throw away any preconceived ideas you have about stories. Some that you may never have heard of before, or the style of the story, and then I want to make a comment after that and give you my take on what this story means to me and how relevant it is right now in the challenging times that we're facing. And then I will read a comment off of a website that's talking about, I believe, something as well that is quite prevalent to our psyche, our thought process, that I wish we would take heart and listen to it as I read it and understand that, ladies and gentlemen, we are in a very challenging time right now. The economic podcast, the SOS, has gone up. The flag is there. It's flying. And many of you I know that are listening to this, and as I always, I hope you would pass this on to people, because you never know what stage of challenge people are in, or even success, that they could pass this on to other people to help them. It's not always the news that's a downer, ladies and gentlemen. It's information and it's application of the knowledge that the information can give you. So I'll take a few minutes of a break, and then I'll get right into the story. And as I say, listen to the story with an open mind and throw out all of the preconceived ideas of what you've heard before or what a story should be like. The story, ladies and gentlemen, is from a book, A Treasury of African Folklore, by Harold Colander. The title of the story, How the First Rain Came. Once, long ago, a daughter was born to the Obasi Oso and a son to Obasi Sia. When both had come to marriageable age, Sia sent a message to say, "Let us exchange children. I will send my son that he may wed one of your maidens. Send your daughter down to my town that she may become my wife." To this, Obasa Osa agreed. So the son of Nis went up to the heavens carrying many fine gifts and aura. The sky maiden came down to dwell on earth. With her came 7 men slaves and 7 women slaves, whom her father sent that they might work for her, so that she could not be called upon to do anything herself. One day, very early in the morning, Obasa Nisia said to his new wife, "Go, work in my farm." She answered, "My father gave me the slaves so that they should work instead of me. Therefore, send them." Obasa Nisi was very angry and said, "Did you not hear that I gave my orders to you? You yourself shall work in my farm. As for the slaves, I will tell them what to do." The girl went down though very unwilling, and when she returned at night, tired out, Nicaea said to her, "Go at once to the river and bring water for the household." She answered, "I am very weary with working in the farm. May not my slaves at least do this while I rest?" Again, Nicaea refused and drove her forth. So she went backward and forward many times carrying the heavy jars. Night had fallen long before she had brought enough. Next morning, Nicaea bade her to do the most menial services, and all day long kept her at work, cooking, fetching water, and making fire. That night, again, she was weary before she could lie down to rest. At dawn on the third morning, he said, "Go and bring in much firewood." Now the girl was young and unused to work, so as she went, she wept, and the tears were still falling when she came back carrying her heavy burden. And as soon as Nicaea said unto her entering, he called and said, "Come here and lie down before me. I wish to shame you in the presence of all my people." On that, the girl wept still more bitterly. "No food has given her till midday on the morrow, and then not enough." When she had finished eating up all there was, Nicaea said to her, "Go out and bring in a great bundle of fish poisoned." The girl went into the bush to seek for the plant, but as she walked through the thick undergrowth of thorns piercing her foot, she lay down alone. All day long she lay there in pain, but as the sun sank, she began to feel better. She got up and managed to limp back to the house. When she entered, Nicaea said to her, "Early this morning, I ordered you to go and collect fish poison. You have stayed away all day and done nothing." So he drove her into the goat pen and said, "Tonight you shall sleep with the goats. You shall not enter my house." That night she ate nothing. Early the next morning, one of the slaves opened the door of the goat pen and found the girl lying within, with her foot all swollen and sore. She could not walk, so for 5 days she was left with the goats. After that, her foot began to get better. As soon as she could walk again, Nicaea called her and said, "Here is a pot. Take it to the river and bring it back filled to the brim." She set out, but when she reached the watershed, she sat down on the bank and dipped her foot in the cool stream. She said to herself, "I will never go back. It is better to stay here alone." After a while, one of the slaves came to the river. He questioned her, "At dawn this morning, you set out to fetch water. Why have you not returned?" The girl said, "I will not come back." When the slave had left her, she thought, "Perhaps he will tell them, and they will be angered and may come and kill me. I had better get back after all." So she filled her pot and tried to raise it onto her head, but it was too heavy. Next, she lifted it onto a tree, then lay it by the side of the river, and kneeling beneath, tried to draw it, and that way, onto her head. But the pot fell and broke, and in falling, a sharp shear cut off one of her ears. The blood pouring down from the wound as she began to weep again, she suddenly thought, "My father is alive, and he and my mother, she is alive. I do not know why I stay here with Obasa Nisi. I will go back to my own father." Then she set out to find the road by which Obasa Osa had sent her to earth. She came to a high tree and from it saw a long rope hanging. She said to herself, "This is the way by which my father sent me." She caught the rope and began to climb. Before she reached halfway, she grew very weary, and her sighs and tears mounted up on the kingdom of Osai-Osar. When she reached midway, she stayed and rested a while. Afterwards, she climbed on again. After a long time, she reached the top of the rope and found herself on the border of her father's land. Here, she sat down, almost worn out with weariness and still weeping. Now, one of the slaves of Obasa-Osar had been sent out to collect firewood. He chanced to stray on and came to the place where the girl was resting. He heard her sobs mixed with broken words and ran back to the town crying out, "I have heard that voice of Ara. She is weeping about a mile from here." Obasa heard but could not believe, yet he said, "Take 12 slaves, and should you find my daughter as you say, bring her here." When they reached the place, they found that it was Ara for true, so they carried her home. When her father saw her coming, he called out, "Take her to the house of her mother." There, one of the lesser wives, Akun by name, heated water and bathed her. Then they prepared a bed and covered her well with soft skins and fine cloths. While she was resting, Obasa killed a young goat, a kid, and sent it to Akun, bidding her preparation for his daughter. Akun took it, and after she had washed it, cooked it in a pot. Also, Obasa sent a great bunch of plantains and other fruits, and they also set properly and orderly upon a table before the girl. Next, they poured water into a gourd and brought a palm wine into a native cup, bidding her to drink. After she had drank and eaten, Obasa came with 4 slaves carrying a great chest made of ebony. He bade them set it before her, open it, and said, "Come here, choose anything you will from this box." Ara chose 2 pieces of cloth, a fine gown, 2 spoons, 2 pairs of shoes, 4 cooking pots, and 4 chains of beads, and the finest cloth that she could find. After this, Obasa's storekeeper, named Ekpenyu, came forward and brought her 12 anklets. Akun gave her 2 gowns, a fufu stick, and a wooden knife. Her own mother brought her 5 gowns, richer than all the rest she had ever seen or touched before, and 5 slaves to wait upon her. After this, Obasa-Osar saw and said, "A house has been ready for you. Go there and you may be its mistress." Next, he went out and called together the members of the chief, the club of the town. This was the name, Agbu. He said to the men, "Go fetch the son of Obasa and see. Cut off both his ears and bring them to me. Him and drive him down the road to his father's town with the message from me. I had built a great house upon here in my town. In it I placed your son and treated him kindly. Now that I know what you have done to my child, I send back your son to you, Ilis, in payment for Ara's ear and the suffering which you put upon her." When the Agbu club had cut off the ears of the son of Obasa Nisi, they brought them before Obasa-Osar and drove back the lad on Earthward Road, as they had done and been ordered. Osar took the ears and made a great juju, and for by reason of this a strong wind arose and drove the boy earthward. On its wings it bore all the sufferings of Ara and the tears which she had shed through the cruelty of Obasa Nisi. The boy stumbled along, half blinded by the rain, and as he went, he thought, "Obasa-Osar may do to me what he chooses. He had never done any unkind thing before. It is only in return for my father's cruelty that I must suffer all this." So his ears mixed with those of Ara and fell earthward as rain. Up until that time, there had been no rain on earth. It fell for the first time when Obasa-Osar made the great wind and drove forth the son of his enemy.
Now
ladies and gentlemen, as I said, that comes from the treasury of African folklore. And the story, at least to me, just goes to show us the maybe fictitious story, but I think it ties into part of the cruelty, part of the disunity that we have right now. You see, Obasa Asaw had to do something. Obasa Nasi had to receive. But who were the real recipients of what happened in the story? It was the children. Aura tried to do all that she could to be a good wife, but her husband mistreated her. And when it finally got back to the girl's father after she had escaped, what happened? He took revenge on the other chief's son. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what's happening right now, in my opinion, with the economy, what is happening with us as people, not just of African tradition, but of many traditions around the world and culture, is that we have forgotten how to treat each other. We've been programmed. We've succumbed to the allure of greed. We think that money will buy everything. Having the finest of things will make everything all right. And when it doesn't, we still mistreat people the way that we think we should and can and get away with it. In the story, ladies and gentlemen, it's not about the specifics of the story, about them having slaves, about the language. It's about two things. It's about understanding the underlying meaning of the story is that not that you have to take revenge on other people, but treat them the right way. And also, the tradition of storytelling in many cultures carries meaning. It carries morals. And I think that's what we need to do more of. We've got to start telling our stories. The individuals that have gone through the Great Depression, whether it's your great-grandmother, great-grandfather, we've got to start telling those stories of how we survived. What is it going to take to move us from this state of depression in not just the economy, but our minds? Because many of us have become so depressed and despondent that we're taking drugs to uplift us. We're drinking. We're doing all manner of things because we want to feel good, because society is telling us that we're imperfect. By the way, our teeth look, our bodies look, and as a consequence, we're losing that contact with each other because we feel less than Madison Avenue perfect. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, that's just my opinion, a long commentary on a story, but I think it's vitally important that we do start going back to the traditions that grouped us together as people, as survivors, because if we don't, we don't think that the cataclysm of this depression is really here, because many people aren't suffering that we see driving up and down the streets in their cars or living in their homes with the lights on and maybe food in the refrigerator, but we don't know their story. They may be maxing out every credit card they have, taking out the last loan on their home in this depressed real estate market. So you see, it's time for us to tell our stories. It's time for us to look at where we are right now, how we've got to this point of prominence and success or challenge, and help other people get beyond it and start collectively coming together and trying to remedy a situation. And now, ladies and gentlemen, just a bit of current news. And this comes from Gary Knoll's website, GaryKnoll.com, and it says, and I'm going to read it. It may be a little lengthy, but I'm going to try and get through it as quickly as possible and make a short commentary on this. But it's an article dated July 6, 2010, Ralph Nader, Hammering the Poor and Vulnerable. There is a reason why so many centuries ago, every major religion warned its adherents not to give too much power to the merchant class. The reason is, and it's still here, the commercial drive knows few self-imposed boundaries, especially when it lends itself and resides in large corporations. A cruel manifestation of the singular drive for maximum profit is how companies treat those who are most powerless, most vulnerable, or most preoccupied. Here are some illustrations that highlight the serious failures of law enforcement. preteen children, the direct marketing to children known as no limits or decency, undermining parental control with preventing marketing schemes and temptations, many companies deceptively excite youngsters to buy massive amounts of products that are bad for their safety, health, and minds. Think junk food loaded with fat, sugar, and salt that increases obesity, diabetes, and predispositions for high blood pressure. Marketers are selling ever more violent entertainment and soft porn with delivery systems that escape parental review or supervision. Television is no longer the only route to children. Our 14-year-old child, and this may be Ralph Nader's daughter or someone he's referring to, our 14-year-old, then, startling book, Children First, A Parent's Guide to Corporate Predators, now reads as an understatement. Number two, the poor, whether white, African-American, Hispanic, or Native American, merchants make the poor pay more. Loan sharks, shoddy merchandise, substandard food products, and inadequate medical care have plagued the poor and been the subject of many studies and too few prosecutions. Number three, people preoccupied by their bereavement are often preyed upon by the funeral industry. The Federal Trade Commission has an ample file of overcharges and deceptive practices from unscrupulous merchants in that trade. Number four, people with rare diseases often require so-called orphan drugs. Under a 1983 law, drug companies receive a 7-year monopoly with no price restraints on these drugs. Drug companies are also given huge tax credits for research and development costs associated with these orphan drugs. The Wall Street Journal has an article, How Drugs for Rare Diseases Become Lifelines for Companies, dated November 5, 2005, called these drugs lucrative niches. With no competition, these monopoly drugs come with staggering prices for desperate patients. Here is one story of how your tax dollars, our tax dollars, ladies and gentlemen, are being used for hyper-profit corporate profits. Henry Blair was working for an experimental enzyme under government contract as a researcher at Tufts University Medical School, working with scientists at the National Institutes of Health there, and he made the enzyme work as a treatment for Gaucher disease, and forgive me if it's not pronounced correctly, G-A-U-C-H-E-R, maybe Gaucher disease, which swells organs and deteriorates bones. In 1981, Mr. Blair Gates started the Genzyme Company, got the company contract to make the enzyme, which he brought to market in 1991. The average price was, get this, $200,000 a year per patient. $200,000, ladies and gentlemen. In 1992, the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, banished by Newt Gingrich in 1995, reported the Genzyme Company spent $29.4 million on the drug, which, with much of the initial research funded and done by the government, which says our tax dollars. 2 years later, Genzyme found a much cheaper way of making the drug. In 2005, the Wall Street Journal wrote that the drug was still priced at $200,000 per patient each year. The company said it would give the drug away at no cost to about 10% of its patients. For the rest, either rely on the insurance companies or pay or die. Now, you see, ladies and gentlemen, I talked about this just a bit about healthcare. I talked about this at length before about what's really driving this. The insurance companies and the drug manufacturers, everyone is making a killing off of us, the little people, and the government that is supposed to protect us, use our tax dollars wisely for roads and bridges and whatever the case may be, are giving away money to institutions that we don't have a clue as to what they do, and they're giving the money away for government research for chemicals that we're turning around and taking as pharmaceutical drugs that are either killing us or extending our lives, but at what cost? To become addicted to the product. Now, I'm going to jump down a little in this article, but I wanted to get to something that really caught my eye. And this is, of course, one of the other things that Ralph Nader is talking about that's really hurting and hammering the poor. Low credit scores. Low credit score credit card holders. The relentless credit card economy that we live in, requiring plastic to buy more and more things and services. The credit score becomes the hammer. A story recounted by MSNBC's Bill Sullivan in his book, Stop Getting Ripped Off, describes the credit card promising an attractive 9.9% interest rate. But there was a catch buried in the fine print that most people don't read. Account setup fee, $29. Program fee, $95. Annual fee, $48. Monthly service fee, $84. Annual additional credit card fee, $20 a year. Then the clincher sentence. If you are assigned the minimum credit limit of $250, your initial required credit will be $71. $51 if you select the additional card option. No wonder the vendors call them fee-harvesting cards. Who needs loan sharks? These credit card vendors fleece the poor, wearing a three-piece suit and sitting in an air-conditioned skyscraper. Such is the fate of the poor and the vulnerable under this boot of commercial avarice. And written by Ralph Nader, consumer advocate. Ladies and gentlemen, this just goes back to really talking about what's happening in our economy. We're quickly sinking into more and more of the depressed economy. Where that may be economic depression for many people, it may be physical and mental depression, not being able to see a way out or a way through. And Ralph Nader is talking about how the poor are so vulnerable. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to make $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to be poor, or $14,000 or less under the poverty limit. Many people are struggling, making house payments, car payments, sending children to summer camp right now, and they're living and surviving off of credit cards. So you see, it's not the poor that are really getting stuck, it's everyone. But Ralph Nader writes this and talks about just the poor and vulnerable. Right now, the most vulnerable is all of us if we don't see what is truly happening to us. Credit cards have become a way of life for so many people. Just think of what would happen, ladies and gentlemen, if tomorrow you got up to use your credit card to put gas in the car so that you could go to work or look for a job or travel or move from the home that you're in because it's been foreclosed on and your credit card did not work. Not because the strip was demagnetized, not because the card is damaged, but the credit card companies and the banks decide, well, we don't really want anybody to use any credit today. We're going to declare a bank holiday because the stock market is in such turmoil. We have enough profit. Most people are pulling money out of the banks than putting in. How would that really affect society? It would come to, ladies and gentlemen, a screeching halt. So, if that doesn't happen, or it never happens, how are you prepared to deal with the fact that you're living on your credit cards? And there could possibly be a day where the credit cards decide, the companies decide that we're just not going to extend you credit anymore. You're too big of a risk. You may lose your job and never pay it back, so we know that you owe us about $5,000, but that's low money. It's all fiat money. It doesn't really exist, so we're just going to just cut you off as a customer. Who's going to enforce the fact that they shouldn't be able to do that without a 60 or 30-day written notice to you that your credit card, your access to that line of credit won't be honored anymore? Evidently, our government has not been really doing a good job to protect the consumer. The Consumer Protection Act, the new Consumer Protection Division that's going to be housed in the Federal Reserve, ladies and gentlemen, and the Federal Reserve is not federal at all. It's a group of private banks and consortiums that set policy and rates for the economy that we're paying back through tax dollars. Do you really think they have your best interest at heart? And finally, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to leave this on a down note, because someone wrote me and said that you talk a lot about what's happening in the economy, or you say that we're in this dire circumstances, and many people may be turned off because you're talking about things that aren't as happy, as uplifting, or even as positive. Ladies and gentlemen, the time for the positivity in these terms is over. We have got to understand there are people that are fighting the good fight. Gary Noel has an excellent website with various people on his radio show on the Progressive Radio Network that are talking about solutions. There are people. Daryl Clark is on his radio show, his station, and he has a show on Wednesday. Go to the website and see when some of these programs are on, or if you can't catch them during the day or the evening, go to the archives and listen. It's not about talking about I'm a progressive or a Democrat or Republican. That has been the divide and conquer strategy. We've got to throw off the shackles of these labels and understand that there are real informative people trying to get us to change our mindset, our paradigm. Dr. Mercola, Joseph Mercola, is out of Illinois. He has a website, Mercola.com, spelled just like it sounds, M-E-R-C-O-L-A. Health information that the mainstream will only touch the fringes of, because the mainstream media, newspapers that are about to die, television advertising gets most of their money from the pharmaceutical companies. The QVC and the shop at home channels all getting you to use that credit card to continually buy things, because you don't feel good about the situation and the state that you're in. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't start using it for positive change, not for another suit, another pair of shoes, an exercise machine, a dehydrator, a cooker, all of those things that if things change and you lose your home, you can't sell and get a damn dime from them because everybody else has got them or decided they didn't need the garbage. It's time for us to start looking. Look at the news where it talks about in the Telegraph. It's telegraph.co.uk, looking at the U.S. economy, that now mainstream newspapers are saying we're in a depression, ladies and gentlemen. And I know most people don't want to hear or believe that, but when you continuously see the government talking about the hundreds of thousands of people that are going to be unemployed once the census decides, once the census is done, if they can't get a job again, they will be counted as the unemployed. The 9.9% is really 20% of the people in this country, ladies and gentlemen, are unemployed. Millions of people on food stamps, 20, 30, if not 40 million of us. And many of you don't notice it because you're not looking at the person in front of you, or they're using the little card and swiping it just like your bank or your debit card. The frustration, ladies and gentlemen, is that when I do the podcast, I may get a few responses back, or maybe a person decides, oh, he's talking negative again, so I think I'll just unsubscribe. When this information, ladies and gentlemen, is not me being grandiose and not being the person that has all the answers, I pull the information from people who have more knowledge than I do on specific subjects and put it together and give it to you. We have got to start sharing this information. Someone, find a relative, a friend, or someone that you know that's in the state of California where they reduced the minimum wage to the state workers to $7.25. Basically, they're telling their employees, the state workers, that they'll have to live on about $1,200 a month. Someone that you know has relatives, friends, family, maybe you do, in Illinois, in Michigan, in the states where unemployment is rampant, where the food that we're eating is so devitalized, but your aunt, your grandmother, someone that you know is a dietitian, and they say it's okay. They're working for a system, ladies and gentlemen, that's trying to keep itself alive, and we have got to keep ourselves alive by the better foods that we eat. Start eating. Try to eat more fruits and vegetables in your diet. If you can't afford the organic, buy just as much as you can of just the food that you can get at the best possible source. Clean it with a fruit and vegetable solution to get the pesticides out, and stop with the junk food. Every major newspaper and television station within the last 2 or 3 years has done some study on the fluoride in the water that's killing us, on the junk food that we're eating that's causing us to be obese, have diabetes, heart disease, and even cancer, but we hear it and we see someone telling it to us on a television station and they're smiling and they go to the next story and our attention span has become so short. It's time we take back our own mentality. It's time we start accessing and using the news that's out there for our own purpose for survival. I'll be back on Thursday, ladies and gentlemen. News that you can use. I'm your host, Daryl Nobles.